on the final day of February, Donald Trump decided to take the biggest gamble of his political career and launch the biggest war the Middle East has seen in decades that is radically and quickly changing the way our entire world works. After months of buildup, the war was launched in coordination with Israel on the 28th of February that immediately involved heavy Israeli airstrikes on the personal compound of Iran's 86-year-old supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, killing him in a sea of fire. Multiple other opening Israeli airstrikes immediately targeted other senior Iranian leadership in an attempt to decapitate as much of the country's ruling elites as possible, which up to this video's production has included the Iranian defense minister, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC, and dozens of others. Within just the first 6 days of the war's start, the U.S. military already carried out more than 2,000 airstrikes all across Iran that have sunk nearly the entirety of the Iranian Navy's major surface vessels, while a separate U.S. submarine strike on an Iranian frigate thousands of miles away from Iran off the coast of Sri Lanka represented the first U.S. submarine kill since the end of the Second World War. America's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has claimed that the opening day of the war involved nearly double the number of American munitions dropped that were dropped on Saddam Hussein's Iraq on the first day of the Shock and Awe campaign in 2003, while the Israeli Air Force has claimed they have been actively striking around 1,000 targets all across Iran every single day as well, a pace of attacks that have been enabled by their newly gained ability to fly over Syria and American aerial tankers refueling them in the sky. Western-based human rights groups have already reported that more than 1,000 civilians across Iran have already been killed by these American and Israeli airstrikes. Military casualties beyond the supreme leader within Iran due to this overwhelming aerial war are so far unclear. But the Israelis have been actively attempting to strike every single IRGC headquarters across the country, and even bomb the building that contained the senior leadership responsible for selecting the next supreme leader. A clear sign that Israel's military objective, at least, is to grind down Iran's military capabilities and cause enough shock to the system to induce the regime into collapse by whatever means necessary. America and Trump's objectives for having started the war, meanwhile, remain much less clear. Trump himself has variously urged on the Iranian people to rise up against the battered regime in a revolution, suggesting it's about regime change, while also saying that he would still be willing to talk to the regime and cut some kind of a deal. His Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has variously stated that America's war aims are to destroy Iran's ballistic missile program and its navy, while his Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, has added that it's also about finishing off all of Iran's nuclear capabilities as well. In justifying the attacks, Trump and his administration officials have variously stated that it was because Iran was supposedly too close to acquiring a nuclear weapon, despite the strikes on Iran's nuclear program last year that had supposedly obliterated their capabilities, to a sense that Israel was going to strike Iran regardless of what America wanted, and so America had to attack Iran first in order to destroy their ability to retaliate to that Israeli attack, to a feeling by Trump himself that the Iranians were supposedly preparing to attack first, and America had to preemptively strike them along with the Israelis. It's all pretty vague, but the biggest reason is simply the cold geopolitical calculus that the Americans and Israelis felt that the Iranian regime was at its weakest point in decades. Iran's water resources had dried up after years of mismanagement and drought. Its economy and currency were both in active freefall, while a large-scale popular uprising against the regime in January was brutally suppressed by the regime's besieged paramilitary units after Khamenei ordered them to begin opening fire indiscriminately. Sensing that these protests were an existential threat against the regime, credible human rights organizations estimate that the besieged paramilitary units massacred a minimum of 7,000 of the protesters, while other estimates go up to as high as 30,000 deaths or even higher. Representing by far the bloodiest crackdown on protesters in modern Iranian history, Trump threatened a clear red line that if the regime began killing protesters en masse, he would intervene militarily. And they crossed the red line anyway, and he initially didn't do much of anything to retaliate. The U.S. military wasn't really in a good position to do so at the time, without even any aircraft carrier strike groups present in the region at all. In fact, Trump's threats may have given the regime a perverse incentive to reestablish their control over their own population at any cost before the U.S. could actually deploy their assets back to the region to respond. But following the ruthless put-down of the protests and sensing the regime's lingering vulnerability, the U.S. began rapidly concentrating their assets back into the region to the largest scale since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. began threatening the regime to negotiate on surrendering its nuclear and ballistic missile programs or face the consequences, and then, eventually, evidently decided to simply attack to force the regime into submission or collapse through alternative means instead. And now the war that he started risks exploding across the entire Middle East. It risks massive destruction to the global economy, and it risks rapidly devolving into a quagmire whose outcome could end up being much, much worse than the world we knew beforehand. The Iranians have decided to retaliate against these existential American and Israeli attacks by basically attacking everyone else around them. Since the war began, the Iranians have fired hundreds of ballistic missiles and thousands of explosive kamikaze drones into the territories of Oman, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Cyprus, Turkey, and Azerbaijan so far. On the opening day of the war alone, Iran fired 180 ballistic missiles towards Israel, and another 250 more at the various six Gulf countries. 5 days into the war, the UAE reported that Iran had fired more than 189 ballistic missiles into its territory, and 941 of their cheaper explosive kamikaze drones, 93% of which they reported were successfully intercepted by their air defenses. Hundreds of additional projectiles have since been fired by Iran all across Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar, while smaller numbers of projectiles numbering in the dozens have also been launched into Saudi Arabia and Oman. And while most of the projectiles fired at these countries have also been intercepted, a few have broken through and damage has been inflicted. In Dubai, the fancy Fairmont Hotel on the Palm Jumeirah, one of the city's famous reclaimed islands, was lit ablaze on the very first day. Debris from an intercepted missile rained down on the exterior of the famous Burj Al Arab luxury 7-star hotel, sparking a fire there as well. While more debris impacted Dubai's huge international airport and fell across residents' own backyards. More notably, Iranian drones have deliberately struck three of Amazon's data centers in the region as well. Two impacted Amazon data centers in Dubai on the opening day of the war, while a third impacted another Amazon data center in Bahrain a few days later, representing the first times that critical AI-related infrastructure have been attacked or damaged during wartime. And all of this has been a major, major shock to Dubai and the UAE's entire economic model, which for decades has been based on presenting itself as a supposed oasis of stability and calm in a dangerous but geographically critical region that links east and west for foreign businesses to set up their regional operations in. It has appealed as a place of residence for wealthy foreigners for decades now, from Arabs attempting to escape the strife in the rest of the region to Europeans dodging their taxes, to Russians and Ukrainians fleeing military service. Dubai has received more foreign direct investment, more AI-related data centers, and is home to more regional foreign offices than any other city in its region because of this reputation, which has led the city to be able to grow fabulously wealthy with its glittering skyline. Now, all of that is in jeopardy because of this war. The hum of hundreds of ballistic missiles and drones flying over the city and the thunder of interceptors blowing them up in the sky and the roar of fighter jets, along with famous hotels and landmarks and infrastructure going up in flames, has shattered the illusion of Dubai being this oasis of calm and stability in a sea of chaos. Not since the Second World War has a city as globally well-connected as Dubai been attacked so heavily during wartime. Foreign residents and companies will inevitably question their continued role in Dubai's future following the conclusion of this war as political risk insurance premiums rise. And naturally, the UAE government is doing just about everything they can to reassure everyone that everything is perfectly under control in order to maintain their reputation and economic model as best they can going forward. Because of the sheer volume of fire that Iran unleashed upon the Gulf states in the first few days of the war, there is a palpable fear that the Gulf states might be running dangerously low on the expensive interceptor missiles they require to keep shooting down any further waves of attack. Generally, air defenses will fire at least two interceptor missiles at each one incoming enemy missile to guarantee a kill as much as possible. Since the start of the war, Iran has fired more than 400 ballistic missiles at the Gulf states collectively, which implies that they've likely fired around 800 interceptor missiles in order to block most of them. An incredibly fast burn rate that is more than 5 times as many interceptors as the United States used against Saddam's army throughout the entirety of the first Gulf War. Critically, because all governments treat the numbers of interceptors they have in their stockpiles as a closely guarded state secret, There's no reliable information on how many of them the Gulf states actually had before the war, and how low their potential remaining stockpiles are now. They're kept a secret because if an enemy knew exactly how many interceptors an opponent had left, they would know exactly how many missiles to fire in order to overwhelm them. All we know is that the Gulf states have expended an absolutely insane number of interceptors since the war began, and replacing them will take years worth of production and billions of dollars. If their stockpiles are truly on the lower end, like many suspect, the Gulf states might have to begin making painful decisions on how to use whatever they have left if Iran fires further waves of strikes, choosing which sites to defend and which sites to leave exposed, possibly forcing them to eventually start pressuring the Americans to put a stop to the war, lest they have to risk their cities and major infrastructure actually getting badly damaged. And that, in essence, is why Iran decided to radically escalate the scope of this war in retaliation by attacking basically everyone else around them, even if they had nothing to do with the US and Israeli attacks in the first place. The US military maintains very large bases and presences in Qatar, Bahrain, the UAE, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, which Iran has used as their justification for their retaliatory attacks on these countries. But none of these countries actually permitted the US military to utilize their bases for the attacks that were launched on Iran. And they wouldn't even allow the US military to utilize their airspaces either. All of the American attacks came either from their aircraft carriers operating in the Arabian Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean, or from their air bases in Jordan, but none from the Gulf states directly. Iran's real aim in attacking the Gulf states the way they have is to try and cause as much damage to the global economy as physically possible, in an attempt to force Trump to end the war under the pressure of even further pain. In addition to the attacks on the cities themselves and the terror they inflicted on residents, consider the damage the attacks have already done to the global oil and airline industries as well. Iranian missiles and drones have bombarded Saudi Arabia's largest oil refinery at Ras Tanura and Qatar's supermassive LNG facility at Ras Laffan, shutting down production at both for an uncertain amount of time. Meanwhile, Iran has also ordered the closure of the narrow Strait of Hormuz and threatened to light ablaze any ship that dares to pass through. For decades, this action has been the most feared method of escalation that Iran has been capable of. The Strait of Hormuz is the most critical maritime choke point in the world, since virtually all of the oil exports of Iraq, Kuwait, Iran, and most of those of Saudi Arabia and the UAE have no other choice but to pass through it towards the world market, as well as all of Qatar's LNG exports. As a result, 1/3 of all the world's seaborne crude oil and 1/5 of all the world's LNG transit through the strait on a daily basis under normal circumstances. And even with the majority of its large surface fleet sunk, Iran is believed to still have thousands of naval mines at its disposal that it can use its large number of much smaller motorboats to litter across the strait, in addition to attacks on cargo and tanker ships with drones and missiles. The result has been that since the war began, the strait has remained effectively closed, choking off a massive amount of the global supply of oil and gas with ships too reluctant to pass through, out of both fear and skyrocketing insurance costs. Some 3,000 merchant vessels of all different kinds found themselves stranded by the end of the first week of the war, representing roughly 10% of the entire global container fleet. Iraq has already begun running out of storage space for crude oil that would normally be loaded up on tankers, and is being forced to shut off production at multiple major fields, slicing production by millions of barrels a day. And the other Gulf states remain in a dangerous race against the clock to get the strait back open again or face closures of their own. Kuwait has warned that they also might need to shut down production shortly, and the UAE soon after that. While Saudi Arabia has the ability to export some of their oil along pipelines out to the Red Sea coast, they might have to eventually shutter the majority of their production as well, since most of it also still has to go through Hormuz. If the strait remains closed for a week, several weeks, or several months, the consequences of all of this held-up oil and gas blocked from the world market will grow increasingly painful for everyone in the world to bear. As of my writing of this script, the price of a barrel of crude oil has already jumped up by more than 14% since the war began, while the price of a megawatt hour of natural gas in Europe has spiked more than 70%. While Asia, who is the most critically affected since they purchased most of their oil from the Persian Gulf, has been the most negatively affected of all by skyrocketing gas and jet fuel prices. The longer the strait remains closed, the higher global energy prices will rise. The higher global inflation rates will rise with them, the lower global economic growth will sag, and the greater money that Russia will earn on their own oil and gas sales that'll benefit the Kremlin's war machine in Ukraine, that Trump is also still ostensibly trying to put a stop to. All of this, of course, is a massive gamble on the part of the Iranians. On the one hand, attacking the Gulf states like this and their energy resources puts huge pressure on the United States to stop the war in order to avoid inflation from growing too far out of control. But on the other hand, doing this directly impacts China's primary source of oil that comes from the Persian Gulf as well and pisses them off, while it also pushes the Gulf states further away into the Israeli camp and also invites retaliatory strikes on their own oil and gas infrastructure and shipping that they overwhelmingly rely on for their economy too. Then consider the damage being inflicted to the global aviation industry. The primary airports at major regional hubs like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and Doha have all been impacted and damaged by the war since it began. With missiles, drones, and aircraft all streaking through their skies, the airspaces were completely shut down across Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, Oman, and Yemen, with partial airspace closures enforced in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. By the end of week one of the war, more than 18,000 flights to the Middle East region had been canceled. Most of them to the major connecting hubs of Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and Doha that are central hubs to global air transportation between Europe, Asia, and Africa. A gigantic hole in the map of global airline routes has formed across the entire width of the Middle East from Iran to the Mediterranean, as everyone avoids the active conflict zone. And with Russia's airspace still blocked off to Western airlines because of the ongoing Ukraine war, there are basically only two narrow aerial highways that have formed to connect flights between East and West. One across the Southern Caucasus and Central Asia, and the other across Egypt and Central Saudi Arabia. All of them longer routes than normal that are requiring more jet fuel to fly at the same time as oil prices are spiking too. As I was writing this script, it was reported that Iran fired a missile into the territory of Azerbaijan as well, reportedly damaging the regional airport in Azerbaijan's autonomous Nakhchivan exclave and wounding four people in the process, potentially representing a challenge to this northern alternative air corridor as well that might even further constrain global airlines' options, and which has led Azerbaijan to also threaten retaliation against Iran. A dangerous prospect for Iran to consider when there are millions of ethnic Azeris who live just across the border within Iran. Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and Doha, the airlines that serve them like Emirates, Etihad, and Qatar Airways, are based on a superconnector business model, flying in long-haul passengers from all over the world to them so that they can connect onto their final destination, which also works well because of their central location at the crossroads of Europe, Asia, and Africa. But as a result of this model and the current airspace closures and airport attacks, tens of thousands of airline passengers found themselves suddenly trapped all around the world with no ability to leave since there were no other flights to where they wanted to go. And the longer the war continues, the longer these passengers might remain stuck, especially in the Gulf region. This is particularly frustrating because the U.S. government has also urged all of the roughly 1 million American citizens who reside across the Middle East to evacuate the region as soon as they can, which for most of them is currently impossible since there are no available flights for them to actually take. Official U.S. government policy for Americans in Israel, currently as of this video's production, is no joke to just take a bus over to Egypt and then take flights back to the U.S. from there. Beyond passengers, the war is hugely affecting global air freight volumes as well. Roughly 12% of the world's global air freight by volume, including roughly half of the air freight between Europe and China, usually passes through the Middle East, which is all practically ground to a complete halt since the start of the war. Inevitably, snarling global supply chains at the same time as Trump's tariffs and trade wars are also doing the same thing. More frighteningly for the Gulf states, the war also stands to challenge the long-standing business models of their airlines and airports as major regional hubs for transport between Europe, Asia, and Africa, as airlines begin looking to more stable horizons elsewhere nearby like Turkey and maybe even Ethiopia instead. And despite how bad things might look right now, Iran still wields the capacity to escalate even further. If Iran is still holding some of its best ballistic missiles in reserve and believes it has saturated the Gulf states' air defenses, it could choose to go for the nuclear option and target the Gulf states' water desalination plants and infrastructure, which, if successful, will have catastrophic consequences. 90% of Kuwait's drinking water is supplied by desalination, along with 86% of Oman's, 70% of Saudi Arabia's, and 42% of the UAE's. In a leaked cable that dates back from 2009, U.S. diplomats wrote that they believed in the event of a successful Iranian attack on Saudi Arabia's desalination plants, the capital and largest city of Riyadh, home to around 7 million people in the middle of the desert, who rely on desalination water piped from the Gulf for virtually all of their water supply, would be forced to be completely evacuated within only a week. No doubt, the Gulf states remain deeply paranoid about Iran's willingness to escalate to this point, which would be existential challenges to their entire civilizations. And if the Iranian regime senses that everything is truly lost, they might end up becoming desperate enough to actually give it a shot. Because of how badly their economies have already been impacted by this war and the potential looming existential risks to their desalination infrastructure, there is serious talk in several of the Gulf states of actively joining the war now on the side of the Americans and Israelis to destroy whatever remains of Iran's ballistic missiles and drone arsenals. Qatari air defenses have already shot down two Iranian bombers that were apparently flying towards their airspace. And they, the Saudis, and Emiratis have all said that they fully reserve the right for self-defense. They might choose to finally open up their airspaces to the Americans for operations or allow their air bases to be utilized as launching off points for further U.S. attacks and retaliation. But by doing so, they would also add to the density of assets in their airspaces that could lead to further friendly fire incidents. Already high after Kuwaiti air defenses mistakenly shot down three American fighter jets early on in the war. And European states are also being dragged into the war whether they want to or not. After the Iranian missile aimed at the British military base on Cyprus was shot down, the British government announced that they would begin allowing the U.S. to access their bases to attack Iran from as well, including from the strategic Diego Garcia base in the Indian Ocean that can serve as a forward operating base for America's B-2 strategic bomber fleet, while Greece agreed to deploy two F-16s and a frigate to Cyprus as well. Another Iranian strike in Abu Dhabi impacted a French naval base there, while the missile that was launched at Turkey, a member of NATO, has even led to discussions on triggering the alliance's Article 5 defense clause, which would commit all 32 members of the alliance into joining the war as well. Out on the peripheries of Iran, it is also being reported now that the CIA is helping to arm ethnic Iranian Kurdish militias just across the border in Iraqi Kurdistan, and is urging them on to march across the border into the ethnically Kurdish-majority parts of Iran. Thousands of Iranian Kurdish militiamen have reportedly concentrated along the Iraqi border, while U.S. and Israeli airstrikes on Iranian military and IRGC infrastructure across the border have potentially opened up a path for them to advance if they choose to do so. This plan, in my view, is a particularly reckless one on Washington's part. Loath to commit ground forces of their own to an invasion of Iran that would inevitably be very bloody and very unpopular, the administration might be currently calculating that it would be better to utilize Kurdish and other ethnic minority militia groups to advance into Iran instead, to hopefully remove the regime from power that way. If the Kurdish militias are successful in taking over swaths of Iranian Kurdistan, then other ethnic minorities might rise up next, like the Azeris in the north, the Arabs in the southwest, and the Baluchis in the southeast. This would be exceedingly dangerous. Iran's population of 92 million people is roughly split between 60% who are Persians and 40% who are a variety of other ethnic minorities. There are plenty of Persians in the country who understandably are furious with the current regime over the bloody massacres of protesters they perpetrated just a few months ago in January. But if they come to view the only alternative as ethnic militias demanding their independence, risking the balkanization of the country in a dark spiral into ethnic Yugoslav-style civil war like what also happened in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, they might become pushed into rather supporting the devil they know than the devil they don't, potentially compromising the apparent American war goal of inspiring Persians towards overthrowing their own government, if the killings of more than 1,000 civilians during the bombings haven't already done that. The civilian population remains generally unarmed relative to the regime, and they likely still fear the regime's ruthless repression and massacres of the last uprising in January, which has no doubt all contributed to a lack of a popular uprising yet forming despite the American and Israeli killings of their leadership and bombings of their military. There are undoubtedly many Persian Iranians who would rather see the unity of their country under a regime they despise than the complete collapse of their country altogether. And while Israel almost certainly prefers the balkanization and collapse of Iran along ethnic sectarian lines like what happened in Syria and Lebanon, since it'll keep Iran from being a challenge and threat to them, it is also, without a doubt, not in either America or the Gulf countries' best interests. on Iran collapsing into a failed state, home to 92 million people, whose water resources are already basically destroyed, will generate a level of chaos and instability that the world hasn't seen since the Second World War. Iraq and Syria's collapses into failed states in the 2010s after the Arab Spring were cataclysmic enough. And yet, they had fractions of Iran's population and fractions of Iran's governmental firepower and nuclear weapons components. The scale of terrorism, bloodshed, refugees, and weapons proliferation spilling from beyond Iran's borders everywhere around it would be an unbelievably terrible situation for the Gulf states, Iraq, and Turkey all to have to contend with, leading to even further and potentially worse risks towards the oil and airline industries in the Gulf that won't simply go away. At the same time, the Gulf states also now fear the survival of the Iranian regime, who could emerge as a wounded but vengeful power after the end of this, who will eventually come back to them for revenge again. Now that they're in this fight, the Gulf states would ideally want to see the regime removed, but without the entire country collapsing. In many ways, the war has already escalated dramatically. Iran's proxy in Lebanon, Hezbollah, has already joined the war and began attacking Israel on its northern flank again, prompting a renewed Israeli ground invasion into southern Lebanon again that is ongoing as of my writing this script that has already resulted in the deaths of hundreds more people. Iran has confirmed that Russian intelligence have been aiding with their military targeting, while Ukraine has offered their assistance to the Gulf states in shooting down Iranian-made drones that they've gained plenty of experience in themselves. The United States military has confirmed that it's begun hastily transferring some of its anti-air assets from South Korea to the Middle East in order to help defend against further Iranian air attacks, potentially leaving South Korea momentarily exposed to aggression from North Korea, while talks within the U.S. military have already come out about a potential plan to seize Iran's Karg Island in the Persian Gulf as the next step along the escalation ladder. Karg Island is a small island that's only about a third the size of Manhattan that's about 25 kilometers off of the southern Iranian coast that many gamers are already going to be very familiar with because it was used as a map for online play in Battlefield 3. But in real life, it's also the single most important economic asset that Iran controls, because the oil terminal on the island accounts for a whopping 90% of Iran's total crude oil exports that overwhelmingly go towards China. Because the waters around Karg Island are actually deep enough to handle modern super large tanker ships compared with the shallower waters around the Iranian mainland that simply can't. An operation to seize the island would place massive, potentially even crippling economic leverage over Iran if it was successful, because it would enable an almost complete shutdown of all of Iran's oil exports that fund as much as 60% of the government's operating budget. The idea in Washington might be that if the bombing campaign alone can't overthrow the Islamic Republic or prevent it from blocking the Strait of Hormuz, seizing Karg Island and eliminating the majority of the government's funding might instead, but without having to commit all the way to a massive ground invasion of Iran. Seizing and controlling Karg Island would inevitably require American boots on the ground, but it might only require a few thousand Marines to take and hold it, as opposed to the hundreds of thousands that will be required to actually invade and occupy the whole country. The problem, of course, is that seizing Karg Island is still a very geopolitically and militarily risky move, with ultimately uncertain outcomes. The US is struggling to get its warships through the Strait of Hormuz right now because of Iranian missile and drone strikes, which means that an operation to seize Karg Island would likely have to largely be an airborne and limited amphibious operation launched from staging grounds at U.S. military bases from Kuwait. And even though the U.S. has been able to maintain complete aerial supremacy in this war, Karg Island is still close enough to the Iranian coast to be well within range of kamikaze drones that can make landing there, holding it, and resupplying it all extremely costly. Moreover, occupying and damaging Karg Island would likely do its intended purpose and knock out Iranian oil from the global market, which stands to spike the price of oil even further as the Iranians continue to bombard everything that moves they don't like traveling through the Strait of Hormuz. And even if the US is successful at taking Karg Island, it won't stop the Iranians from continuing to blockade the Strait of Hormuz by keeping up their attack campaign there. And the loss of their oil revenue might only encourage them to continue escalating, potentially by expanding their attacks against regional desalination infrastructure or against oil and gas pipelines, especially the Saudi and Emirati pipelines that can reroute some of their oil away from Hormuz, If those desalination plants and pipelines were damaged in a tit-for-tat exchange for the loss of Karg Island, Saudi Arabia and the UAE might be forced, with no other choice, but to join the war directly against Iran on the side of the Americans. And the global economy would only continue suffering even worse. Basically, Iran still will have the cards to play up the escalation ladder, even if they do end up losing Karg. And there's no guarantee that the loss of Karg will force them to the negotiating table. The only way to stop their blockade of Hormuz at this point is to either negotiate on terms that the regime will deem favorable, or to remove the regime. And thus, Trump himself is now caught in a deep hole of his own digging. If he bows to the economic pressure that Iran is generating, he will infuriate Israel and Netanyahu, who want to see this war through to its ultimate conclusion in removing the Iranian regime from existence. And he will undermine the Gulf states' trust in America after the U.S. dragged them into a war that they didn't want, only to leave them with a vengeful Iran still standing. If he abandons the war now over the pain it's causing, it will also show to the Iranian regime that their strategy of pounding the Gulf states with attacks is a successful one that they'll inevitably just replicate again in the future, which gives more impetus to the Gulf states to now see the war through to the end now that it's already been started. But on the other side, the longer that Trump continues the war without removing the regime, the more the global economic fallout will rise. The more it will likely drag on his popularity within the United States that was already struggling beforehand, especially since YouGov polls have shown that only 27% of Americans supported this war to begin with, and the more that some foreign countries may begin pressuring for a ceasefire out of their own interests. This is a difficult time in a difficult situation, and one of those weeks where decades happen. And figuring out how to get out of this mess before it gets any worse will be a truly Herculean feat. But something that is very much figured out, on the other hand, is what you should watch next, or at least put on your list, and that's my Mad Kings series. Mad Kings is a Nebula original, meaning that it exists only on the streaming service that myself and a whole bunch of other creators put together called Nebula. It's a show that explores the darker histories of some of modern history's most well-known dictators, including other recent historical figures who were overthrown through U.S. military interventions like Libya's Muammar Gaddafi and Iraq's Uday Hussein, along with episodes covering the reigns of North Korea's Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il that explores how they were actually able to avoid a U.S. intervention. And then there's also my other series on Nebula called Modern Conflicts, which explores modern wars, battles, and conflicts in a level of depth and detail that would never work out on YouTube without triggering this site's demonetization and age restriction policies, with episodes you can watch covering the Israel-Palestinian conflict, Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th, the overthrow of the Assad regime in Syria, and Israel's invasion of the Gaza Strip that all explain the crucial backstory information that you need in order to understand what's currently happening in the Middle East right now. These are my own projects, but there's also just so much other good stuff on Nebula from other creators right now that you can watch too. There's Day Pass, hosted by Jason from Not Just Bikes, which explores the world through the lens of public transit down on the ground. If you wondered whatever happened to Lindsay Ellis, she's been making her usual documentaries on Nebula for years now instead of on YouTube. There's Patrick Willem's latest short film, The Dinner Plan, featuring big names like Griffin Newman and Zach Cherry. There's Abolish Everything, our new comedy debate premise recorded live in New York. Scav, a docuseries produced by the Wendover Productions and Jetlag folks tracing the incredible drama and unfoldings of the world's largest annual scavenger hunt hosted at the University of Chicago, and Oldest and Newest Places by Joe Scott, a full-length documentary exploring where the oldest and newest rocks on the planet are and what it takes to actually visit them. I could honestly keep going and going, but just believe me when I say that with every month that goes by, the Nebula catalog keeps getting deeper, making becoming a subscriber even better. But we also need you to help keep this whole cycle going. We have a great deal running right now that when you use my link at nebula.tv/reallifelore, or by scanning the QR code here on your screen, or by clicking the button, you'll get a whole 50% off of an annual Nebula subscription, which will bring the cost for you down to just $30 for the entire year, or $2.50 per month. A small fraction of the price of either YouTube Premium or Netflix. As other streamers keep raising their prices, this is an awesome deal. And if you want to sign up for a lifetime subscription to Nebula and never deal with a monthly subscription ever again, you can get one for 40% off right now for $300 as well. So give us a shot, and thank you so much for supporting not only my own channel, but all of the other creators who are building Nebula with their own awesome content as well. And as always, thank you so much for watching.